Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It's Monday, March 30th. What's up, Kato?
They put Oreos on the bottom of like a lasagna once. I hate it.
Kato, what are you talking? I'm doing an intro. That was lead-in. We can't bring that. It's episode 303. I'm your host, Austin Walker. I'm joined by Rob Zachney, Patrick Klepek, and Ricardo Contreras, who you heard already talking about Oreos on lasagna, which I think is not that sort of energy we need to bring this week. Kato?
Hang on. You know what? I don't approve of breaking into the intro. No, Patrick, we're doing this. I don't approve of breaking into the intro, but I do need to know, like, lasagna, Italian lasagna, or was it like a dessert lasagna where an Oreo would make some sort of thematic sense?
No, this was like layers. It was
like Garfield.
This was some cartoon-ass shit, for real.
Like, Garfield has standards. I feel like Garfield would reject that and say, make a new lasagna.
There was Oreos on one. Here's the thing. The Oreos were the last layer put onto it. So it was like kind of normal lasagna layers to start out. And then like a layer of focaccia bread just on top. And then some meat and cheese and pepperoni. And then another layer of focaccia bread. And then a fucking layer of Oreos.
This is... Also, I do appreciate briefly, Patrick, I do want to say I briefly appreciate the belief that Garfield is a lasagna purist. I think that
Well, no, I so if I was to expound on that further, I believe he would still eat it. He would just tell you, I reject this. As you go off to eat the new lasagna, he would realize, well, I mean, it's still lasagna. And he would eat it, but then he'd also have the new one cooking and heading down the line.
I'm looking for this thing.
That's a Monday lasagna. Little shout out to my Garfield fans out there.
You know what it is.
Oh, Jesus.
Garcast.
Yeah, welcome to the Garcast. Kato, I have to tell you, I've gone, as a journalist, I always try to verify the claims of my sources to keep the source safe. I don't see this anywhere.
Anywhere. Shit, where did I see it? It was on Twitter, probably.
Yeah, well, a lot of shit's on Twitter.
Yeah, right, Kato, that is not...
Two videos spliced together.
Yeah, I think this is a false memory.
No, because they cut a slice out of that shit and showed you all of the fucking horrible fucking
this was just like a parody of someone just making fun of these videos. Like, yeah, what if you put Oreos in a lasagna?
What if you put a focaccia bread and pepperoni?
Hold on, is that not the aesthetic of Tasties, to make ridiculous shit?
That's the thing, is like, Kato's example sounds unbelievable to me, but the problem is, it's only a little past what I consider the threshold of believability for Tasty videos. Like, if I were presented with proof, I would probably not question it that much, right? I wouldn't be like, oh, but what is the provenance of this evidence? I would probably just be like, oh shit, that's real.
I'm gonna leave it to our viewer, to our listeners, to find this thing. I believe you that it exists.
It was real.
This is not the time for me to go down a search, like a search hole, which is normally what I do in these moments. Instead, we're gonna do a podcast about things that are not Oreo lasagna, which. Yeah, you're like, this week. You're like, we can just keep talking about this shit.
Look, honestly, you know what? You know, I'm sure we're going to get into some, you know, how we're all doing. I just want to know what Rob's cooking these days. Like, I feel I can mark the where we're at in society based on where Rob's kitchen is at. That's like, people have different markers.
That's
like,
what it's called.
You put your finger
The Rob's cooking show is just called Rob's Kitchen. It's straightforward, but it's homey. You know what I mean? Come on over to Rob's Kitchen. It's perfect.
See, I think Patrick, though, was proposing like a Rob's Kitchen Index, which I see. Would have been like
the Rob's Kitchen scale.
Yeah, would have been like middle class try hard Waffle House Index.
Right. Do people know about the Waffle House Index? Is this a thing?
I think the word is out now about the Waffle House.
We should make it clear. Yeah, if there's one in four that doesn't know, then that it's worth repeating.
Craig Fugate, or probably Fugate, but I like Fugate, former head of FEMA, quote, "If you get there and the Waffle House is closed, that's really bad." The index is an actual informal metric, but it's used by FEMA to determine the effect of a storm and the likely scale of assistance required for disaster recovery. Green, full menu, restaurant has power and damage is limited or no damage at all. Yellow, limited menu, no power or only power from a generator or food supplies may be low. And red, the restaurant is closed, indicating severe damage or severe flooding.
Wow.
Waffle House. Think about it this way.
Yes, go ahead.
The thing is, it's really tough to do on-site damage assessments all at once. How do you get through to a reliable source? Mm-hmm. But every Waffle House location has a phone number that you can call, right? And you can just like talk to the manager. So like to an extent, you can take a really fast sample size of like what is happening in a region of the U.S. by calling these restaurants and seeing what's going on. The thing that I've never understood about it is, why is Waffle House this this like Man of War ship of the line like class dining establishment that when every other restaurant, when your McDonald's are closed, when your Walmarts are shut down, Waffle House remains open? That's what I'm curious about, right? Like,
they have a culture of it. They have a culture, supposedly, of good risk. This is all from Wikipedia. Good risk management and disaster preparedness. This is like,
wow.
What this is definitely someone's pet, like, feature of the brand, right? Someone inside is like, I'm the defender of the fact that we will be up and running immediately. I understand that the reason that Waffle House is successful is because we are the heart of the people around us, and they will feel good about us indefinitely if we can open up quickly in these situations. And I think part of that is like straight up, they just have generators ready to roll. They have a limited menu. So it isn't just someone's pet project. It's also they've invested in like processes for situations like this. They have a playbook for when the main power is knocked out, for when certain things are spoiled. You know what I mean? When the refrigerator has died.
But it's remarkable that shit hasn't been cut. Right?
Yeah, totally.
Like,
yeah.
That somebody hasn't come along and been like, you know what those generators would make us just on the aftermarket?
Right.
Let's just liquidate our second generators. Do we really need to be open? Like, that's what's remarkable about it is like that Waffle House appears to be a chain that it is important and viable and responsible to remain in business, as opposed to what is the general motif in American life, which is let's sell our redundancies. Let's eliminate all the cushion we have against unforeseen impacts, and fuck those people.
Yeah, totally. There's a quote here. I'm not going to read the quote, but I do want to note the person who wrote its name is Dan Stone King. Great, great Dark Souls boss.
A follow-up to Tiger King.
God. I have to start working my way through it. I'm nervous. People have been giving me warnings.
I've watched the first 15 minutes. It hit the culture enough that, like, I'm on the back end of the meme, but that's when I want to get in. I'm like, cool, people are getting past this. Now's my time to get in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How's everyone doing? So, Rob, your kitchen situation. How is the kitchen?
Where's
the
good.
Kitchen? Where's the Rob's kitchen? Where's the RKI at right now? Okay.
RKI is my artisanal goods producers are starting to get slammed.
I've heard flour is legitimately hard to come by in
I have
places.
To use the store brand. I don't have my King Arthur's anymore. So I guess I might as well feed that to the sourdough starter once I get that rolling. Yeast is like There is a shortage of yeast. There wasn't any available at the store the last couple times I went, so now I'm down to my last like half canister of Fleischmann's, which does mean I need to figure out how to create like an actual like starter culture,
like a starter, right? Like this is the thing that's interesting about that is like that's not so much as there is a you can't do anything. It just really removes the margin of error, right? Because you can't just rush out and buy more. You really got to nail producing it yourself,
right? And it, like the thing that's always made me hesitate is the starting stages of getting a starter created from just the yeast and bacteria that's like just ambient around the home. That's the tricky stage. And once you have like a good starter culture, you are pretty much good to go as long as you keep feeding it. But that opening stage is just kind of a pain in the ass and not entirely appetizing sometimes. So it's a bit like you invited a little bit of like a bread monster into your home, I think, in the early stages. So, but there's no choice. Like, the thing that's going to allow us to really batten down hatches is the ability to continue producing, you know, bread here without having to go out. So it it just has to be done. Fortunately, it appears things like, you know, residue from beer and such can be used a little bit for this. So we'll see how that all goes.
Just take a napkin and just wipe down the counter. Like, we're good to go. There's some spillover from the night before.
Yeah, like, if people have good advice, I'm open to hearing it. Because, like, literally, right now I'm pulling from, like, 8 different things I've half-skimmed. And I don't even know how advice, you know what I mean? Like, right now, I have a bunch of things that I haven't really vetted. How good is this person's information versus that? So it's entirely possible, like, what is rattling around my head right now is a really good recipe for food poisoning. So we'll see. But
don't do that.
No, I don't think that's a huge worry. Not with this. The pickling station we've set up, on the other hand, I think that's going well. I think it's going well.
Hell yeah.
But I have a vague botulism fear. But that's just a phobia. That's not founded on anything.
Yeah.
That's just my knowledge of like what is the worst case in a pickling, like in a home pickling situation. It's botulism. If you do everything right, what's the likelihood of it? None, basically. But nevertheless, I'm looking at it like, is it going to be the pickles that gets me?
Yeah, what gets me in the end? Yeah.
Yeah, is like it is the red onion that's pickling right now? Is that the red death at my masquerade? But no, the frustrating thing today is, so people have figured out that my town has a really good local dairy that provides you with a bunch of stuff. And for a while, like, that was kind of my little secret. Because I've been ordering from these folks for like a year. But now everyone has been like frantically Googling, hey, how the fuck do I get like fresh dairy delivered to my home? And so my reliable little milk delivery every week has just been thrown into chaos. And didn't even recognize my milkman today.
Oh, no.
Yeah, complete stranger to me.
Wow. Have they hired up? Is that what's happened here?
They've hired up, and then I think somebody also came along and swiped my first order.
What?
I had a call for a redelivery. I was like, it's not here. The empties are gone, and my delivery isn't here. So they sent someone back through and dropped something off. But like, I am now paranoid that, are the milk bandits out there? Are there people pilfering my goods?
You just have to be a little more attentive to your milk,
Rob. Well, that's like, am I gonna have to put the empties out next week? Put the empties out and then go over to the tall grass and weeds in the roundabout near my apartment and just make camp there.
I think so. I think you're going to need to stand guard. I think ideally what you do is a Robert Redford, Paul Newman sting operation, you know? I think you have to honestly get involved. I think you need to understand what the scale of the operation is, and not just who's grabbing a bottle of milk here or there, but, you know, does this go all the way to the top? You have to figure out how big this entire operation is, and maybe you could bring it down from the inside.
It could be a scandal that brings down Northeastern Dairy.
It really could. It really could. Patrick, Cotto, how are the two of you handling the current moment of our time?
Man, it's... Wow. Why would I take it? I have 2 full-time jobs, basically,
right.
Is the thing. You know, we've found a dynamic with having Jessica home all the time, but it's really hard. You know, my wife has a much less flexible job than I do, and she's up against some time crunch stuff that just makes it where she has to be just really, she's one of those people that's in meetings all day on a phone call. So
right.
She's like locked away in a room, and gives me space bar. I can, but it's like this very strange dynamic where it's like most we try to shift it where it's like on podcast days, she watches her for the time that I'm doing this, or at least as long as I can do it before she barges in the room as people have found on previous podcasts. And then it's like, okay, well, it's not like I'm taking a break from work. It's like, then I need to spend, like, it's a whole different creative energy trying to keep her entertained because, you know, you find the limits of screen time. You find the limits of the things you've done in the past. And the weather has been trash out here recently, where on some level, while people weren't taking this really seriously, it was helpful because I didn't have to be always the mean dad that's saying, like, we can't go near those kids because yeah. those parents are irresponsible. Now people are staying inside. But boy, that cuts off your ability to just walk around the block. Like, she, it's actually helpful recently. The Park District finally, Illinois, although it's a little bit behind some of the states and is supposed to be sort of a hotspot in a couple of weeks, has been really aggressive about precautionary measures. And finally, last week, they had informally shut down all of, like, the parks and stuff like that. But now they formally went and did that because the assholes weren't abiding by it. So now there's, like, you know, like, yellow tape and a big close sign. And so at least now I can tell my daughter, like, look, there's the close sign. She's like, oh, that's because of the germs. Like, yes, that's because of the germs. Because otherwise it was us walking by it and kids on the swings and me just like, okay, my kid's going to scream and cry because you decided to be the asshole that can't handle telling your kid no. So I don't know. It's like, and weekends are even tougher because on some level during the week, it's like, all right, I'm going to kind of ignore my kid for a little bit and work. And like, that gives me something to do. And then on the weekend, it's like, cool, all that. No, you don't have that excuse anymore. It's just your kid all day. And also you have lost 95% of your tools to right. try and find things to do with them. And it's just, yeah, it's exhausting is what I would say.
I identify with that a lot. It sounds a lot mm-hmm. like having a dough rise a couple times. You just live according to that thing's schedule. It gets demanding. It gets pushy.
Of course.
You just have to be there. There's no of days course. Off.
I mean,
that's
know.
What commitment and responsibility really does look like. Kata,
you
want to
talk
you?
About commitment? You want to talk about running a small town, a small community on an island?
In the time of crisis.
Get up. Yeah. Having to get up every day, you know, early, make sure you get those turnips.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Check those prices.
Check those prices.
A friend of the sites, I won't name names, someone maybe who you, well, see, now if I'm too vague, it'll sound like I'm throwing the wrong person under the bus.
Oh, this is off to a good start.
Oh, you know what? You know what? It was made public, so I'm just going to read some messages here from Joel Fowler.
Ah.
Very, very pro tip. Do not time travel when you have turnips. Joel bought a bunch of turnips, and then it hit 12:15, and he had more money, so he time traveled to buy to a Hawaiian time
Hold
zone.
On.
What's up?
Time travel?
Change the you know gamers gotta like make everything.
Oh, did
they
he
do
some international Dateline nonsense?
He didn't. Not even that. He just like rolled the clock back. Yeah, but yeah, like he just went like because the okay. So Rob, every day before every Sunday before noon, you get a visitor to your town. You get Daisy May to the town, who is of course the granddaughter of Sal. Was it Sal Joan?
Yeah,
Sal Joan. These characters, of course, run the stock market and sell you turnips at a price. And then throughout the week, you can flip those turnips for more money in the main shop. And time travel is when you move the clock around. In this case, what Joel did was moved it back to when Daisy May, this little pig girl, was still around selling turnips. The game knows you do that, and so spoils your turnips. And suddenly, this huge investment Joel had made had evaporated into rotten turnips covered in flies and ants. That's my advice to you is don't time travel. You can't win stonks by time traveling. Yeah. You got to win them the right way. Good old American insight and determination.
Right. By selling them within the week that you bought them.
By finding someone online you've never met before and going to their town and selling them for a 600% markup.
I think the most American way of handling that would be to force the government to buy your rotten right. turnips at the 600% markup.
You're totally right. 100%. Fuck. Well, that's my advice. Kato, how is your Animal Crossing? We're talking about video games now. Let's do a quick, quick Animal Crossing check-in.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Good. I got Mabel. Mabel has clothes for me now.
Me too. I got some good shit.
It's good. It's great. It's been going well in there. I mean, I've got the campsite set up, so I'm getting new visitors. So that I can get rid of some of my normies, because
Oh, are you getting ready? You're going to, like, flip people out? You're going to be like, get off my fucking island? I want better people?
Oh, boy. I mean, some of them are just like, come on, we can do better than this.
This is what your crisis management mayorship? You're the resident representative.
Yeah.
That means that you have a responsibility. Those are your constituents you're getting rid of because they're quote unquote too normy. I'm sorry that your district doesn't represent the demographic you wish it did, but they elected you.
Austin, a society is like a bonsai plant.
Right.
Oh my God.
It needs a careful gardener / sculptor. And if Kato has a vision,
I have
say
a
what
vision.
You will. At I least have... it's a vision.
I think it's a different type of tree. I suspect it's more like the Tree of Liberty. And I think it may be time to water it. If Kato is our tyrant.
Anyway,
so good. So it's going well. All said, it's going well.
Yeah. That game is great. It opens up more than I thought it would after the residence building is there. Like, there's a lot more to kind of chase a little bit.
You can pick your thing. You can really pick your goal at that point and say, okay, what am I going to slowly work towards?
Right. I accidentally bought a Godzilla without realizing that there was also an upgrade for your pockets in that when the residence services opens.
I hate it when I buy a Godzilla I could have gotten a bigger pocket instead.
Yeah. There's a bunch of new things that you could buy for Nook Miles. Like, finally, I understand what Nook Miles are for. And it's basically for a bunch of ridiculous decorations, which are fun. One of them being a Godzilla. And also the
recipe.
One of them
being a recipe for a Gundam, which I'm working on.
It's going to take me a long time. That thing requires a lot of fucking materials, huh?
It does. The hard thing is going to be those rusted parts, which only show up.
How do you even get those?
They show up in the Lost and Found sometimes, and then when Gulliver shows up, if you don't turn in the things to Gulliver, you get to keep them as rusted.
If you strand him,
he's gonna get stranded anyway. His friends don't love him. Don't worry about him.
That's true. They don't answer.
So that's about where I am now too. Able Sisters has opened up. I feel like I'm in the part. I've gotten to the part of the game where I was like, let me pump the brakes. Like, I got all my stuff set up. I can now check in for 30 minutes or an hour or 2 hours instead of playing the game like a new release, which is also part of the thing. I ended up thinking about this after our last episode. Or I meant to say it during our Animal Crossing episode, but I think part of the reason you see a lot of games journalists go really hard on this game in this moment is because other big games are like literally here. And we need to get the shit off our plate or get to the part of the, we have to get like the tutorial off our plates so that we can go on to play Resident Evil 3 or Final Fantasy 7 Remake or Mount & Blade Bannerlord, another huge release dropping today.
Oh, you know, the trilogy of March games, the ones on everyone's tongue, Final Fantasy 7, RE3, and Mount & Blade.
Blade people are going to come for you.
You're they damn right
have
we
been
are.
Waiting in the hills. Oh God, Austin's one of them.
Austin's fucking leading
they're
the
inside
charge.
They're inside the walls.
100%. 100% I am. That game rules. I have 40 hours in Warband. I wish I had 400. I'm excited for Mount & Blade, the new Mount & Blade, Bannerlord. Mount & Blade 2 Bannerlord to come out. Or it's out now. I'm excited to play it today.
I like the alternative interpretation of that title, which is Mountain Blade. Like, I'm going after the Mountain Blade.
The Mountain Blade. Yeah, exactly. Blessed by the gods. Those games fucking slap, honestly. 1,200 reviews already, very positive. Dropped today.
Are those still largely made by, like, it's like a couple?
It's
right?
I believe it's still a tiny studio. My guess is it's probably more than that couple now.
But its origins are, right, like, that this couple kind of made this, like, At least I remember that being the origin story of that.
Yeah,
that
is, like, yeah. Yeah, the original Mountain Blade was like a two-person project. Yeah. Which, for how good it was astonishing, and for how big it was astonishing.
I'm so curious if...
It gets less astonishing given how long this has taken.
Yes, and then also it's been... There have been a lot of medieval combat games in the time since, in terms of like chivalry, and what was that big one last year that people loved?
Mordhau?
That one for sure. But it's a different thing because it's also a strategy, like role-playing thing in some ways.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are these games? Because I've...
We don't need to have. We can do this. Let's do this segment next. Let's
when
do this
back, segment when you played on it.
When I've played it. Yeah. But you can go check it out. Mountain Blade, Mount End Blade. Can we talk about some of those upcoming new releases that I teased that I said were coming out? Patrick, I know you've been playing one of them.
Yeah, I have played. At least according to Matthew Galt, who wrote our review that just went up. I think I'm about halfway through. Resident Evil 3, a game I am crushed to report I don't think I like at all.
No!
No!
Oh, this head is terrible. Oh, no! The head is fine, but it's a... It's...
Yeah, the headline of Matthew's review is Resident Evil 3 is a crushing disappointment, and or a boring disappointment, which actually is more... It's crushing, but boring is more accurate to... what it's like to play the game. I mean, it's such an interesting game to play relative to Resident Evil 2 and thinking about Final Fantasy 7 coming up in a couple of weeks. Because when we're entering an era where the remakes mean something to me, right? Like if you remake Super Mario Brothers 1 or something, like, it's interesting. But I was so young that I didn't grow emotional attachments to those games. I enjoyed them, but it wasn't until you hit around your teenage years where you start like really like grounding yourself in those formative experiences. Like Final Fantasy VII is one of those for me. Resident Evil is one of those for me. And so like playing Resident Evil 2, which I consider to be more or less a perfect remake. It's such a smart way to... what I always imagine, remakes kind of tackle things in different ways, but if when I imagine what it felt like to play Resident Evil 2 as a child, like playing that now, playing that update feels like they just plucked it from my brain and just boop, that's exactly what it was like back in 1998 or whatever. And like, that is the exact feeling is recreated here, and it's updated, it's tweaked, it's new, new technology, but it feels like it's capturing the same energy, down to the fact that the last third of the Leon Kennedy campaign sucked back then and it sucks now, and they should have just like done something different instead of just taking that from RE2. RE3 was that team. This isn't the team that worked on Resident Evil 2. It's a different team. Was faced with like a much tougher problem because RE3 was always just... It wasn't ever a particularly good... It had a good idea, which was like, what if you take the tyrant-type character and like these lumbering Jason Voorhees, sort of like slasher villain characters, these unkillable, lumbering creatures that stalk you throughout the game, and what if that was the whole game? What if that was the entirety of it? And then having played... But RE3 was just kind of a boring game. Like, that's it. People remember the Nemesis part. It's an iconic design. It's an interesting premise, but it wasn't a particularly good video game. And so, as opposed to RE2, which is... It's not one-to-one, but it's one-to-one-ish of, like, just take what was there and just, just make it shiny and polished and brand new in 2019. Resident Evil 3 was faced with, well, actually, we're going to have to kind of make almost a new video game. You can take the story beats, take the characters, take Nemesis, but you're faced with, if you were to just take it one-to-one, that would be a difficult translation to do. And especially having played RE2, where the Mr. X character, it was truly terrifying. Is one of, the more distance I have from Resident Evil 2, the more I feel it is, one of the the moments in Resident Evil 2 where I would be on the first floor of the police station and would hear the creaking sounds of Mr. X on the second floor, and I could know where he was positionally in that police station as I was trying to make my way you know, with a weird, you know, clover key or something, or I'm trying to sweep up the last couple items, and then hearing him getting closer, naturally the extension of that is like, but what if you did that for an entire game? Maybe that could be really interesting. And they just didn't solve that problem because Nemesis is not interesting. Nemesis is not some lingering threat that is constantly stalking you throughout Resident Evil 3. I mean, like, they are, but it's mostly just set piece stuff, right? Like, you're kind of going about a place, and then occasionally Nemesis shows up, and then his logic, like, the logic of the creature doesn't make any sense. Like, he stalks you, can destroy, like, in the cutscenes, it's demonstrated he has unlimited power. He can, like, crush through buildings, like, things, nothing stands in his way. But when he's actually chasing you in a sequence in Resident Evil 3, well, boy, he's just having trouble going into the door of that toy store, and he's just going to stand around the corner and stare at you through that window. And he doesn't, like, go to an idle animation. He doesn't, like, walk off to do something else. He just stares at you and then...
just becomes a guy in the parking lot.
Yeah, and then, like, he'll open the door and he'll be like, oh, time to make stars. And he'll, like, lumber his way over to the door, and then you'll back up.
What?
And then he just stares... well...
time to
so
make
that's what happened
stars?
To the Dunkin' Donuts guy.
Yeah, is that he get a new job?
Well, Nemesis'
time to
whole
make
thing
the stars.
Is he's been engineered. I don't know how this works, but he's been bioengineered to only go after stars, which is the you know, like the police force that, you know, found the, you know, the mansion in Resident Evil 1, and then is like dedicated themselves to taking down Umbrella. And Nemesis does not go after random civilians. This is not just like a bioweapon that's like going after everyone. It's just, it walks around going, stars.
If I quit stars, does it stop coming after me?
I think he knows, but I'm not as rich on the detailed.
That's your paperwork.
Detailed.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, I put in my 2 weeks, Nemesis. Like, leave me alone.
You're
All
still
right,
on Cobra
you
benefits.
Can go in.
Close enough.
And so, you know, he has like an expanded moveset. Like, he can brandish guns. He has like this tentacle he can like shoot at with his arm. But it's just not, it's not fun to interact. It doesn't feel like a system designed creature in which you're trying to be clever. Realistically, what you end up doing is that in the occasional times when he's chasing you, what's new in Resident Evil 3 is you have, at least when you're playing as Jill Valentine, you have a dodge move, and if you time that dodge correctly, you can kind of evade almost anything. Like, the screen goes white, and it like is saying like, "Hey, like, good job, like you made it past the thing." And you can do that with Nemesis as well. And so it's like he'll be like winding up for a big punch, it's like whoosh, dodge. But the thing is, like, you're running forward, and he's chasing you from behind. And the difference in old Resident Evil, which had, yeah, like, you know, fixed camera perspectives that were largely, you know, like, isometric in, often was the case. It would give you, like, a very specific overview of an area. And if it was doing something that was stylistic, it was, like, what it was hiding was part of the point. Like, it was trying to be, that was how it was generating tension. But a lot of camera angles in Resident Evil 3 were, like, if you go and watch, like, a Let's Play, it's, like, a lot of them are higher up over on top of Jill Valentine, specifically because it's trying to give you like a lay of the land for how to like dodge Nemesis. And here you don't get anything like that. It's a behind the shoulder third person game. And so there's all these moments where it's just like, I don't even know what Nemesis is doing. I know it's chasing me, but I'm just kind of like slapping the dodge button every couple of seconds when I feel like maybe it's behind me. And then occasionally Nemesis will be like, ah, you've gotten stars, you've gotten too far from me. Kind of sounds piratey-ish the more I try to yeah, do this voice for Nemesis. He can jump in front of you and like he'll like, you know, like stomp on the ground. And you know, I guess what typified it was I just did this boss fight that takes place on the top of a roof, and it's the first time where you're supposed to like load bullets into Nemesis. You know, he's an unkillable
machine.
Is that
code for shoot?
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
And
gotta load some bullets into this guy, uh-huh, if you get what I am saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, because they're just lodged in there, so you're just kind of loading them into him. I'm not sure the bullets are really doing a whole lot necessarily. But you know, you're not encouraged to like waste any of your ammunition on Nemesis until like this sequence. And then you're just supposed to dump, you know, whatever grenade launcher, whatever shotgun stuff you have into him, so you can just kind of slow him down and you can escape. And the set piece is a rooftop where there's nowhere to get away. it is like an electrical circuit breaker that's, of course, on the fritz. And like right before you get up there, there's a note that says, by the way, we've put those circuit breakers up there and they're on the fritz. Definitely don't shoot them or sparks would go everywhere. Which on some level could be charming, but the way this game plays it is just not particularly like charming in its sort of like weird straightforwardness of what it's communicating. And so he gets up there. It's the first time you can use the flamethrower. And I just walked in a circle around these two sets of pieces of wood, and I'd wait for him to empty the, you know, his flamethrower liquid. I don't know, like what goes in a flamethrower exactly?
Liquid?
Is it just gas fuel. And it's in yeah. the
it's a fuel? It's probably a special sort of fuel, right? It mm-hmm. sticks on things as part of what it does. Anyway, yeah, we don't need to get into the particulars of flamethrowers. They're gross.
And I just, yeah, I never got hit, was never in danger. I just walked in these like slow, methodical circles, would peek out, hit him with the grenade launcher, and then, you know, the cutscene rolled. And it's just, it's not a scary game. It's not a tense game. It's not a very interesting game. I you know, you don't want to like review the game that you wanted it to be instead of the game that it is. But my hope for Resident Evil 3 was to take Mr. X and the systems of Mr. X of a thing that is stalking you, and that what is you as a player, what tools do you have, whether in Resident Evil 2 there weren't tools, it was just like using your audio cues and your survival instinct to just avoid him.
Right.
This doesn't build on that in any meaningful way. I mean, Resident Evil games prior to RE4, where RE4 went full action, and RE3 was about that transition between those two. RE2 started it to some degree, RE3 picked it up, and right. it was just, you know... Resident Evil as a series followed the arc of a lot of horror movie series, which is that eventually it can't be scary, so it, you know, the set pieces are become more grandiose to make up for that. And Resident Evil 3 just doesn't even try to be scary, and specifically, you know, part of the arc of an RE game is usually like, for the first like half, you're gonna have to conserve your ammo and like be careful about your shots, and then by the second half, if you've been, you know, a hoarder, you're going to be an unstoppable killing machine, and you're going to have way too much stuff at the end. Like, that's just kind of how the way the games are built. And this game is like, what if we just do that immediately? And like within the first hour, it's like, I have way too many handgun bullets. I have way too many shotgun bullets. You know, there's one of the cool new enemies is like, I don't know how to even describe it. It's kind of like a pinkish flesh face, and then it opens up and it's got these really creepy mandibles. It's a, kind of like a Cthulhu, you know, esque sort of thing. And when the first time I encountered it, it was like very scary because it like lunges forward as it opens up, and then you kind of like spam the shotgun and just try and get as many shots as you can get in. It's like it takes a lot to get down. It was a really threatening fight. And like literally around the corner from that enemy was the grenade launcher and flame rounds and a note that says, hey, by the way, these things are very susceptible to fire. And it kind of instantly kills them. And then I found like seven more of them, but I just shot them with the flame rounds and killed them with one shot from a distance. And it's like, what are we doing here?
Why even put them there?
Yeah. So the game is just full of
Patrick, I just want you to know that was the most Brecken-esque I've ever heard your voice raise. What are we even doing here? That was extremely Nick Brecken voice. Here's my question. Here's like my actual biggest question is when I played Resident Evil 2, the thing that really, really brought me in was that feeling of clearing spaces, of like effectively moving across this map. And feeling like, hey, there was this. It was all the stuff that had nothing to do with the action, which suggests to me that I'm not necessarily going to love this game. But like, when I think about that game, it isn't even the horror, because if you remember, like that didn't hit me directly. But it was that feeling of exploring a space, finding keys, clearing out rooms, knowing I didn't have to go back to a room, slowly piecing together, go to point A, go to point B, go to point C, jump across the map here, run away from Mr. X. Like that stuff was fantastic. It wasn't frightening to me, but it was really adrenaline, you know, it really gave me a big a good dose of adrenaline, and I liked it as an action game, and I've been looking forward to Resident Evil 3 because what I'd hoped was it would give me that part of the feeling, even if it, because of its more action-y angle, wasn't trying to do the horror thing as hard. I was hoping that it would still give me this sort of like almost Zelda dungeon clearing feeling. Is that just gone here because it's so focused on set pieces, or
it's just so it's a much more linear game. And you know, RE2 at times, mostly in the police station. Again, this is through the Leon Kennedy route. That's I know that you did the Claire.
Yeah. They're still very similar route, though. Yeah.
You know, like the police station for at various points feels very open ended. Like you have different options, even though if you like look back, like it's you know it's very funnel driven. But there are times where it feels like such a big space, and you know you get a key, and it's like, oh, now I have six different things I could go be doing, and I'll go check yeah. those off yeah. as I work through the new layer of the place that I've unlocked. And there just isn't. At the point that I'm at, from what I understand, you know, I didn't RE3. I didn't actually play on the PS1 for whatever reason. So this has been new to me altogether. And talking to Galt, he said that there is at least one location, the hospital, that is the closest this game gets to like a larger space that you're spending a lot of time in. Mm. I'm assuming that must be like around the corner for me, and must be like take up most of the back half of the game because I haven't gotten to that sequence yet. But otherwise, no, you are going through very strict linear sections where, like the thing they've done in Resident Evil 3 is, you'll go through a space where you're really just going forward, from one section to the next. There's not a lot of, exploration or, and actually in this case, it still has the mechanic of in your map. It doesn't turn blue until you've collected all the items, which mm-hmm. was very useful in Resident Evil 2.
Yeah,
I thought
I
that
it.
Worked really well for you being able to find everything. I found that to be like a very satisfying a part of the exploration. Here, because the environment's all that interesting, because there's not that much to look at or do, what I ended up doing is like I'd walk into a space, and then the first thing I do is like, is this one blue already? Immediately? Cool. I'm just going to just run to the door on the opposite end, avoid these zombies. And it like took me out of the experience in a way that was working much differently than Resident Evil 2. And even in the spots where they're trying to harness some of that, it's just, I don't know. I didn't find that. Maybe there's something unique to being in a confined, like constrained space and, you know, working through the layers of that. Because Resident Evil 3 is much more exploring parts of the broken parts of Raccoon City as the outbreak spreads. Like Resident Evil 3, I believe the timeline is it takes place before Resident Evil 2 and then during Resident Evil 2. I don't know where the timeline ends, but like there are moments where in Resident Evil 3 where it fills in some character stuff for moments in Resident Evil 2, which are kind of cool if you care about that stuff. But no, there's really like that kind of Metroid-y style elements are just not here nearly to the same degree. Like the closest it gets to it is when you're going through an area, some doors will be locked because they have like a chain, and eventually you can get, you know, chain cutters, or like there's like this universal Raccoon City like lock that your lockpick can get through that is everywhere. And so you'll carry one of those in an inventory slot. And when you go back through a space, you'll unlock those. I mean, just to give you an example of like how crude and rudimentary this game over and over in the same way that I mentioned the flame rounds being found around the corner from an enemy type that then immediately sort of neutralizes the tension of that enemy type. So one of the first major puzzles in the game, slight spoilers, I guess, is a safe where you need to find the combination, like classic Resident Evil puzzle. I'm like, okay, well, I'm looking all through the room that I was in, like maybe it's here. And so like I'm spending all this time looking at this painting, be like, maybe there's like a hint in here, like it's the leaves, and it's, you know, and it becomes clear, no, that's just a goddamn painting. You can just keep walking, and then you'll probably come across something that informs you on what to do. And what you did is like I walked down, I went across the street to, you know, some convenience store, and in that convenience store, I think did you see in the Discord that we're in the main channel? I pasted it earlier. I might have to scroll back a little.
I'll
bit.
I'll look for it. What's up? You got it. Is it when a friend of ours, Matt Kessler, shared the incredible song Into Free Dongen from Dragon's Dogma? Is that what you're talking about? Another fine
no,
Capcom product?
No, it is not that. Here, it is
this. Oh, yes. I did see this.
So I walk into this convenience store, and I'm wondering, like, how are they going to cleverly hide the combination for this safe? And like, no, it's just on this poster of a highly sexualized women promoting aqua care.
Aqua and cure, please escape
aqua
to
cure, please. Sorry,
ecstasy.
And there are these numbers on it that have been circled, and it's not even like the game, like hey, figure out which one is left, right, left. It has left,
arrows.
Right, left on it, like as though like he wrote. The only thing that's missing here is that he didn't do it in his own blood with his hand, yeah. Like to mark it.
It's really
so obvious. Like it's like if Nemesis itself is a brute force, obvious object. That's what everything else in RE3 feels like, is a brute force, obvious object. Yeah. It feels like they nailed the aesthetic part of it. It is gorgeous. It is beautiful. There is some wonderful body horror stuff going on here. If you, you know, like the kind of like the grotesque stuff that is sometimes part of what I find like really appealing and interesting about Resident Evil. A lot of that's here. It is amazing to look at. And Nemesis is really creepy and weird. It's just not that fun to play, and I find myself disappointed at just how limited the imagination was for what this interaction with Nemesis could be. That said, it seems like it's like, you know, it's like 8 hours. Like it's like it's fine. Like it's absolutely fine. Like I'm once I accepted what it was, and that normally when I play a horror game, it's like turn down the lights. I'm gonna get a drink. I'm gonna make sure actually the fireplace isn't on too much, because if it's too high, then like it makes it a little harder to see the dark colors on the projectors. Like I've got this ironed out. Like this, and I'm not doing any of that in Resident Evil 2. Like my kid's running around. I'm like, it's fine, Jessica. Like the game's not making any attempt to scare me, so I'm not gonna make any attempt to like meet it halfway on like setting up the perfect atmosphere. Around me, so it's a okay, beautiful action game, but relative to the highs of RE2 and what I thought was possible for RE3, it's not what I was looking for. So I think go in with adjusted expectations, and I think people will be maybe able to meet the game where it is, as opposed to what I was hoping it could be.
Well, that is the biggest disappointment of my day so far, but it's not even noon yet, so, you know, we'll see how the rest of the day goes.
Give it time. Yeah. It's, you know, the news these days has a way.
Exactly. Let's take a break while I bemoan the fact that I won't be able to... I mean, I'm still going to probably try to play this game. I've been looking forward to it a lot, and
it's an easy play, right? Like, it is very much a turn your brain off.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's...
Progress through a thing.
Progress through a thing, like it's
I gotta
fine.
Say
it's just that RE2 I thought was
sublime.
It is truly great.
Yeah.
And this is just not anywhere
the
anywhere
the biggest bummer for me here, or I remember when this was announced going, it's coming out next year, that's quick. And I hadn't I had thought like, oh, well, maybe they were already starting work on it, blah 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 blah, but I really wish they had taken another year to go over all of this design, it sounds like, and maybe do more than just like make certain encounters better, but rethink how to make this game in a stronger way. I don't know.
I think for the way they're approaching making these games, that this is what they arrived at makes sense, because if you look at what they did and didn't do to Resident Evil 2, not that there wasn't a lot of work put into that game, but it wasn't. It's not like a fundamental reimagining of Resident Evil 2, right? It is both not as simple as just a new coat of paint, but it is not as complex as developing like a brand, like starting from scratch and just taking some base level elements. Like it is still very much the core of Resident Evil 2, that original game and what made it work. And I think for better and worse, that's also what this is too. Like, and it was playing with a much more flawed foundation, and they didn't put in the effort to rethink what is that foundation? What if we tossed out like a bunch of it and just like reimagined what Resident Evil 3 could be and what it means to interact with this creature? And so I see why they arrived at this. And I think if what Capcom is going to be doing over the course of like the next, you know, 5 years is more than likely taking the same approach to the entire franchise, right? Like, I don't know if they'll go as far as Resident Evil 4 or Code Veronica, which would be more, ambitious, or maybe not, right? Because I think right. The ambition is the disappointment is that these remakes aren't that ambitious. They're working within the constraints of those original designs and then adding 2020 or like modern and flourishes and technological stuff and mechanical advancements. But RE2 was not a fundamentally flawed game if you were just to take that to now. RE3 kind of is. And so if they just move on to a Resident Evil 4, that's still a really good game. And if all you gave that was modern graphics, it's still going to be like a really good game.
Yeah.
But like a Code Veronica, a game that was only good because it was a Dreamcast Resident Evil game and the visuals were spectacular, that game does not hold up at all. If you gave that game this treatment, it's still going to have all those problems. And so honestly, like my final note on this, because I know we're about to break, was just that the RE2 team was so smart. Boy, I wish Capcom would just let them go make a new Resident Evil game in that style. Yeah. I'll take, if they task them with an RE4 or Code Veronica, I think they'll do a terrific job because they had a real eye for what to tweak and where to approach what they can improve and innovate on. But boy, would I love that the cadence of Resident Evil going forward was like a team like theirs doing a more quote-unquote traditional Resident Evil while experimental first-person stuff is happening from another team. Because that just sounds really exciting.
The thing that I'm curious about at this point is like, okay, is next year another first-person Resident Evil from that team? I don't know what the team divides are at Capcom, to be 100% clear. But like, is that the next thing? And then we get an RE2 team project that is new, or maybe the year after that is another. What I would have loved would have been is like the Call of Duty system, right? Where there's three teams working on three things, where we get a remake, a first person game, and then a new sequel from now the RE2 team that is better than the new sequels that we were getting in, the six and the seven. And the,
It kind of seems like they're in that direction, whether it's as formalized as, how Activision got that way. It's like, doesn't some pretty informed folks in the horror community that it sounds like, RE8, which was supposed to be first person, has like run into some development troubles and kind of got pushed back a year or so. So, we'll see. I agree with you. I think that would be really cool.
I meant five and six, by the way. I said six and seven, which were bad. I did not mean that seven was bad. I meant five and six. I meant
seven was the good one, right?
Five had the co-op.
Yeah, I think seven is a masterpiece. And some six has you're off the six is just is bad.
Six is the one that was just became like a campy action.
It's 30 hours long too. I played that whole game with Brad, and it was mostly just our emotional energy. The audacity of the game propelling us forward is like, all right, I'm 15 hours in. What am I gonna do? Stop now? Mm-hmm. Like, no way. I'm gonna see this all the way through. And RE5, I know, has its defenders, despite it being like a patently racist video game. I know that some people do defend that game's co-op as being, like, if you look at it as an action game with exceptional co-op, apparently it's good. It's just I tried to play it as a single-player game and didn't like it. And then, can you imagine what the end guy, the only person who raised those comments about that game,
dude,
and how controversial they were at the time, how that would be. Well, one, I don't think that game would get made now, probably.
And I'll be curious to see what they... those comments was, like, such a big part of me. And then getting, the backlash to those comments, it was, like, a Newsweek blog post, basically, at the time. Probably some tweets, but I think it was before I was even on Twitter.
And he was also on...
Oh, right, he was on the podcast,
One of yours was really big at that time, and I remember that's...
that was a poolside.
It was a big deal.
That was one of the
E3 ones.
At the Fig. He went in on some of the visual language of that initial trailer, which was very much wielding blackness as a club, wielding Africa as a weapon against the sort of like, to produce a sense of terror and fear, explicitly presenting like white protagonists, white women in danger from black men as like the way to stoke the viewer or the player's sense of terror. And Guy was 100% on point.
Well,
But Austin, it was made in Japan.
No, remember, so know? Remember though how generous Engai was.
Oh, 100%.
He was like, the whole thing got boiled down to is Engai Kroll saying this game is racist. And he was 100%. Saying, no, these images have a history. That was the phrase he kept coming back to was these portrayals, these images have a history that is connected with racism. And that was a really generous interpretation, but nevertheless, like, it was a real grim foreshadowing of how this discussion would always go, where critique of a pretty obvious aesthetic direction and influence and subtext gets boiled down to, oh, this game is racist. And it's like, it may not even have like a racist pedagogical purpose. It just is swimming in a really tainted pool at this point. And that's always how this discussion has gone ever since then.
Yeah. And it was that the pushback on that, the like complete refusal to engage with the argument in the way that you're talking about, Rob, the way in which a very particular argument was being deployed and it was immediately turned into, he said Capcom was racist, was a huge motivator for me to like want to get into this space, because it became increasingly clear that it was not just like, hey, no one's hired anyone black before at one of these major sites. It's, hey, there's only like three people, black people I know, who have salary jobs in this industry. It was also like, oh, and it turns out once you get that job, you are expected to stay out of those sorts of conversations. You should not have any expectation of having your particular experiences trusted, or your perspectives and expertise, be allowed to be brought to bear in situations like this. And it was like so infuriating at the time. Shout outs to Engai Kroll, who has always been very nice. And also
his voice is missed.
I miss. I was going to say, like, in all this stuff, one of those very selfish moments of like, man, what do the 2010s look like if Engai stays in Game Crit, you know? And the answer is the 2010s look like the 2010s, but I get to read from someone else I respect a great deal. Shout outs to Engai. All right, we should take
a
break.
When bloggers wrote essays.
The good old days. God. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
All right, we return. Rob, how are things going on your end besides the trying to find a yeast starter? What are you doing to occupy your like gaming part of your brain in this moment?
Oh gosh, I'm making all kinds of questionable decisions.
Yeah.
Okay. So it hit me this last week where I'm like, this is starting to psychologically just wear on me a little bit, and I was like, you know what would feel really good right now? To go back to Control. No, not the DLC that just came out. It's topical. I'm saying replay the entire game.
Oh, right, because you played that on Xbox, right?
Yes.
So when I sent so I sent you a code a week and a half ago, and you never responded to tell me it was a useless code for you. So it's been a Control
it's not DLC useless. Code. It's not useless. It's going to be a little treat for me at the end of this playthrough of Control. Like,
I also did in my link. Didn't I give you a link to a full? There was a game save download, so you could just jump into the DLC.
Oh well, that's why you should read these entire messages.
There was a Dropbox link to a save sent by the PR.
Oh, I thought that was just assets. Oh, silly me. Anyway, point is.
Oh my god! This is how you didn't find two of the fucking abilities in Control.
Bad signposting. I agree.
Damn.
So
get him.
But the other reason I'm playing through it again is so now I'm playing it on the PC with just maxed out everything. Like, I was like, let's live that ray tracing life and see what that's all about. And it looks good. Like, it is, like, I'm really enjoying playing through the game just to see how absurdly vivid and lifelike it comes across. And now that there's a photo mode, I'm totally fucked. Because every single scene, I have to, like, stop and be like, I must capture this. I spent, like, 25 minutes trying to line up the perfect picture of Jesse Faden regarding the vending machine with the blank, the white label packaging for all the snacks. I spent like 25 minutes trying to get the shot of like the perfect nonplussed reaction to that vending machine. So that's one of the things I've been spending my time doing is photo documentary work in the world of Control as I play through it again on PC. And that's felt pretty good. I also have been playing, still wrapping up Vampyr. I've gotten now past where I was before. Okay. So now
I'm in, where? How far? There's like what three areas?
Yeah. So now I'm late in the West End, where all the rich people are. Okay. So I just got to what feels like a late game decision, and so, like some stuff I hadn't seen before, which is I got to decide what to do with a super rich, like magnate guy who wants to become a vampire. And this really douchey club of vampires, the Ascalon Club, who are very much like, it's like vampires meets Masons, I guess. They're very much like, oh, well, you know, of course, as a new member, you will naturally induct this guy into our number and you'll give him the immortality he deserves. And I was like, I don't know about that. And then literally the next cutscene is sort of your guide, Lady Ashworth, being like, dude, that guy sucks. Do not turn him into a vampire. He is an arch-capitalist shithead. And if that guy gets immortality, we're all fucked. And then you go around London and you ask everyone about, like, hey, do you know anything about this Aloysius Dawson character? And in case you haven't gotten the message, every single person in London has a strong opinion about what a piece of shit he is. So now I got to figure out how to sort of gracefully extricate myself from turning this guy into a vampire. And I'm not sure what options the game is going to offer me. I suppose I'm not sure if it's also just going to let me murder the guy rather than turn him. But I've definitely hit the stage now of the game where I'm also ready for it to wrap. Like, I've mastered the combat.
Core story is not that great, and the combat is not that great. Like, there's a certain, like, post 15 hours where, like, all right, the atmosphere is no longer really doing it for me. The side quests aren't, like, it's just, like, what was propping it up for so long, the parts that work really well, just the spell starts to go away, and it's like, all right, time to just push forward and see this plot to its conclusion.
Yeah, they did a really good job of stretching a limited amount of resources and story over, you know, a pretty expansive game, but they did too good a job, right? At this point now, we are thoroughly in the butter scraped over too much bread stage of the experience. And there's only so many times you can go around to a district and, like, have the sad the sad violin music start up and the rain begin to fall and people start wailing in the streets. And it's like, yeah, boy, this plague is, oh, I hate it. Oh, it's so bad. Anyway, I'm just gonna steal all these coins out of your house. Do you have any just random shit you need someone to do? Like, you looking for anything around here? Sorry,
just anything
about
at
your
all,
kid.
Really?
Yeah. So it's the game it reminds me a lot of at this point is The Darkness, the first Darkness game.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think The Darkness had RPG elements, but fundamentally it was an action game, and as an action game, it had the good grace to wrap up pretty quickly. Like, it had its different acts, and it had sort of a hub and spoke structure, so you went through different parts of the sort of grief-stricken, haunted New York throughout The Darkness, But it didn't linger over this stuff. There weren't a ton of side quests in the darkness where, Jackie, you need to go and find that person's necklace and give it to their mom. Or don't. Maybe you want to be evil, Jackie. God. Like, there wasn't that shit. Whereas Vampyr is very...
Is that all, Nemesis?
Yeah.
Vampyr is very much about that stuff. And it's completely run out of tricks. And now I'm like... keenly wishing the thing would wrap up, but also keenly wanting to replay the Order 1866 at the end of it, because now I've gotten a little bored of like Rob. Waistcoat and facial hair like combat aesthetics in Vampyr, but I'm ready to go back to the source, which is the Order and that cool white phosphorus gun they have.
Great.
I never played that game.
Me either.
What?
I watched some footage. I watched someone... I didn't have a PS4 at launch.
Diaz posting about didn't turn you around on it?
No.
That game is so good.
All my memory is just ensnared with, it was very pretty, and then all the reviews were like, this is very boring to play, and so I just never got around to doing anything but watching trailers.
Just foolishness. Just rank, rank amateurism.
What made the Order good?
So the Order...
Was it the mustaches?
I mean, look... The game style does count for a lot, right? It very much is like Full Metal Gilbert and Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
But I think there's something else, which is that the Order is very much playing around. It's like the Order's taking sort of a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen type idea where the Knights of the Round Table still exist, but now they've also invited famous historical characters to join their ranks. It's the cast of Hamilton. Well, it's Lafayette, at least. He's one of the guys now.
Has he turned on the revolution yet, or which era of Lafayette are we?
This is kind of a naive fuck up, so really could be any era.
Okay.
But probably more French Revolution. But I think what makes it interesting is that the Order 1866 is basically the Knights of the Round Table have been fighting an endless war, a forever war, one might say, against like vampire kind and threats against the English Empire for like literally centuries. And what do you know, over the process of this, these embodiments of chivalric code and honor and decency have turned into just ruthlessly efficient killing machines with absolutely no capacity to question orders or direction or fit their actions into a larger context. Like the Order 1866 is basically a loyal, loyal commando, like unfortunately having his first original thought in literal years and how quickly that makes him completely anathema to the organization he serves, how quickly all his friends turn on him, how quickly he becomes a traitor just for the first time asking, like, are we just basically conducting terror raids in parts of the city to keep people in line and quash our enemies? Like, does any of this serve a greater purpose? And the minute he questions that, he is, of course, on the run.
Right.
So it works out pretty well. Like, I think the game story is actually more interesting than it comes across. There is it does do all the steampunk bullshit. Like your gadget guy is Nikola Tesla. Like you're not getting around that. Like, oh man, I need to upgrade my equipment.
This is
Nikola Tesla. What are you doing here?
I've played enough Assassin's Creed games. Yeah, like I can get past that part. It. That's not going to be the hangup for me.
I am realizing so much that the Order 1886 is the most Waypoint 101 game I've ever looked at. This is the sort of thing that in a different world we would have tried to cram into our schedules and been miserable about at the end of the month when we realize.
No, we would have loved it. Well. No, none of Rob you would have been on that show. It. Me and Dia would have done the show by ourselves. It would have been great.
I would have done it. This looks like Binary Domain with ties. So,
oh, it's so much better than Binary Domain.
Ooh. Different strokes. I'm looking at this game and being like, well, how long is this game? This game's like 5 or 6 hours. Maybe I play this game. I don't know. Well, I could buy Neo 2 and finally have someone on this site put some time into that. Instead, catch me playing The Order 1886. God, anything? Oh, let me shout out a couple things. I've not talked about the things I played. These are quick because I don't think either of them are dramatic big new releases. Did I lose internet connection? No. Oh, video is just weird. Oh, okay. Rob is just looking down, presumably, at a video of The Order 1886, his true love. my two...
No, you got a mysterious phone call.
Okay, oh. Weird. I hope it's not too mysterious or scary. Two big shout-outs for me. First is Gordian Quest, a game I already did a shout-out to a few months ago or a few weeks ago when I first started playing it. It is now out in early access on Steam. Gordian, G-O-R-D-I-A-N, Quest. Gordian like the knot. I think it's a bad name. But I think it's a pretty good game. It's an early access. I pitched it before. It's like Slay the Spire meets Darkest Dungeon is kind of what they're going for. There is a mode where you can play with like permadeath and some other stuff, but by default, it's kind of more of an RPG campaign with a Slay the Spire style, with a Slay the Spire style combat system. In the Darkest Dungeon style, like rank and file, move your characters around system, maybe a little more complex than that. It is extremely satisfying to play. The combat moves really quickly. It feels good to unlock new skill trees for your characters and like add, literally drop what are basically new sphere grids onto your sphere grid. I think the visual design is kind of generic in some places, and the writing is also that. But it's very light, and it makes for really, really good. I need to put my brain on anything else for a few hours. The first act is available now on Steam. It's like $18 right now on Steam. And I think early access is going to just roll those extra characters and extra acts and stuff out over the next year or something like that. But I think it's if you want to like give yourself over to a thing for 10 hours, this thing is ready for that to be that for you. The second thing is a game that I originally played in early access. Again, that was called Gordian Quest. The second thing is a game that I originally played in early access. Having played Gordian Quest, I was like, huh, I wonder what happened to that. And then like almost instantly I received a message about Deep Sky Derelicts coming to Switch and I want to say PS4 and Xbox One, but at least Switch. This is a game that again is very much indebted to Darkest Dungeon in terms of like feeling like the characters are comic ripped from a comic book page, like a dark, grim, you know, Silver Age comic, sci-fi comic in this case. It's about kind of scavengers in kind of dystopic space universe, sci-fi universe. Who are being sent into the ships to scout them, to recover missing parts, and inevitably, you know, eventually to locate some like ancient relic ship that you're going to recover for a major corporation who will pay you a lot of money. It again has like a deck building element to it as you get as your equipment provides cards for you in like the same way that Gordian Quest does. I think Gordian Quest is a lot more fun to play moment to moment in terms of just raw ass interaction, which is so important when it comes to these sorts of like card game RPGs. It needs to feel good to play a card in these games. It needs to feel good to swing to like select an attack from your menu. But the vibe of Deep Sky Derelicts is very good. I think it was kind of slept on because it got that early access release that made everyone want to like wait for the big release, and then the big release hit on PC and like it did okay. But I think it's probably better than it's mostly positive reviews on Steam, but it's probably better than the attention it got, if that makes sense. I really like the feeling of like moving through these and mapping out these kind of blueprints of the derelicts. The kind of like tile-based map, setting up, you have this resource that's constantly ticking down that is just like energy for your gear. And you can set up like energy generators that make certain tiles free to cross over. So like you can kind of set one of those up at like the choke point or at like the entryway to a big hall. That way, whenever you're exploring the main area, you're not burning through energy. There's all sorts of interesting decisions layered on top of each other. So shout outs to those two games, which have been giving me the exact sort of brain scratching I need in these troubled times. so yeah, those are my two quick shout outs. Anything else we want to hit before we wrap up?
I want to shout out the Room VR. But usually what happens is like whenever some big VR game comes out, it like then I'm like, all right, I haven't before I put all these cables away, like try and spend some time with other VR games. And so because of Half-Life Alyx, which I liked a lot, then my thought was, yes, I'm going to get there, Austin. I just switched
to a better link. It's fine.
Uh-huh. Yes. No, I definitely wanted to bring that up before we wrapped. Yeah, The Room is started as a iPhone and iPad puzzle game, with a very Lovecraftian sort of a theme, at least aesthetic theming. But the whole attraction of The Room games was that, you know, they originally, like back in like the beginnings of people creating like sort of like touch based games, it was like the tactile feel of like interacting with an object. And so the appeal of The Room was like, here are these intricate puzzle boxes that you're, you know, spinning around and touching little pieces and like dragging this one around. It was the feeling of, you know, pulling one lever and watching six things spring out from this complicated piece of machinery. And then they built a whole universe around that. I loved and played like the first two games and then kind of fell off it after that. But they'd made a number of them, and they've been since ported to, you know, Switch and consoles and stuff like that. And I think it works okay on non-touch-based devices, but it's always been the case, in my opinion anyway, that they function best and feel best when you're really just kind of like sliding your finger along sort of like the crevices of these devices. And so they put out the Room VR a couple of days back, and I played about 90 minutes of it, and it's really neat. It's a different sort of tactile feel, because obviously in this case you're not touching a screen, you have these controllers, but like the main interaction point is gripping things. So like with the controllers I have, the Valve Index ones, it can detect when your fingers are resting on the controllers or if you're lifting them off. And so you can do that individually with all of your fingers, or you can like do it as kind of like as a fist. And the way the game works is like, if you're grabbing objects, you need to physically like close your hand with some amount of weight against the controller, which then will then grab an object. So you're doing that to, you know, grab a Switch, or like to, there are a lot of objects where you like have to spin things around, and I'm having to like put my hand in weird locations to alternate between them in order to move things around. Or there's a rope that I had to pull, and so I'm doing that. And I think it works really well. It's gimmicky in the ways that VR is good at. And the puzzles themselves are really, really well done. So I've enjoyed the 90 minutes I've played. If you've liked the Room games before, this is another good one of those. And interacting with it in a different style has been satisfying. So I think that's on PSVR and the Oculus stuff, and also on Steam for various headsets.
Awesome. This thing, go ahead, Kato.
I was just going to ask if they got Tommy Wiseau for the game.
We're going to move on.
No,
this
not.
Story came in. Yeah.
Obvious joke is obvious.
Come on. These games have been coming out for years, you know? You got to get that Wiseau in for the first one of these.
Right.
Get your Wiseau in where you can get it. I get it. But Eurogamer, backed up with a second report now by Video Games
Flipped around.
Chronicle.
Eurogamer is backing up the original report.
Oh, is it? So VGC is the first one. Video Games Chronicle is the first one. VGC, is that right? Is that correct? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I see. Have reported that Nintendo will be releasing several new releases, so several new re-releases, remasters of some Mario games.
Well, it sounds like they're going, like,
this sounds like a lot.
Suggesting that essentially to celebrate the 35th anniversary of Mario, that Nintendo's going to try and get the vast majority, if not the entire Mario library, on the Switch to as part of that celebration, and specifically that they're doing, you know, who knows what the, you know, again, like remakes, remaster, yeah. Like they're like the sliding scale on what that means can be a lot, but that, you know, Super Mario 64, Mario Sunshine, 3D World,
Galaxy,
Mario Galaxy, like 3D World specifically apparently is going to get new levels, which is I've been beating this drum for years that I think Super Mario 3D World is a top three Mario game that people just haven't given its due because so many people didn't buy or spend much time on a Wii U. But Super Mario 3D World is just a truly excellent game. And I've been so, as much as I like Galaxy, I've been so more desperate. Like, people already know Galaxy is good. They just want to play it again and have it look a little nicer. Whereas, like, 3D World, like, just vast majority of people have no sense of how great that game is. And so the fact that that's coming back with new levels, that just makes me so excited. And I guess they're also going to port the number of the Paper Mario games, and there's a new Paper Mario game coming to Switch. So this would help explain Nintendo being a little bit quiet. I had heard some scuttlebutt that, you know, some of this stuff was maybe supposed to be kicking off with this Nintendo Direct that happened, and things have just kind of...
Yeah.
Lots of things have been thrown off for this year, now that coronavirus has gone from being a scare to an outright pandemic. And I think I would back up Jason Schreier's report from some weeks back. He's like, look, everything that's coming out in March and April is probably good. And then you should probably just throw your hands up at what's going to happen to the games that come after that.
Yeah.
Just because the thousands of people working from home, tens of thousands working from home, is just going to throw things off. But this is really exciting news. This would be great if this all happens.
Yeah, honestly, it probably deserves a whole big event all of its own, right? Like, hey, here's our Mario Direct. Here's what's up with Mario. Paper Mario, like, here it is, right? That'd be fun.
Finally.
You know what? People always say, when does Mario get his month? I think every month is Mario's month, and he doesn't need his own designated month. In my personal opinion.
Mario Sunshine, like a remaster of Mario Sunshine? I want a reason to replay. I'm also a Mario Sunshine stan. I'm here for...
What?
Oh, yeah. I won't go to the mat for it, but I think it is disproportionately disliked for, like, how interesting. I like that game. Whereas 3D World, like, I'm ready to fight. Like, I'm throwing it on the streets for Mario 3D World. Mario Sunshine is mostly like, I don't think it needs to be the punch. So, like, I think with Mario Sunshine, people become stans of Sunshine because people who don't like it really don't like it. So then people who liked it end up like being like, well, you're an asshole for hating, you know what I mean? Like, it's like it, because it pulls so hard on both ends that people end up I think maybe overstating their I liked that game when it came out fundamentally because it was just a different way of interacting in a Mario space. Like, it was just, it's weird, it's a weird video game. And so I'm hopeful that a remaster or something like that would, I mean, it would have to like have the controls kind of like rethought in some ways. So I'm curious. Anyway, Mario. More Mario.
Patrick, I need you to know that on our side, you've been cutting out for most of your beautiful defense of Mario Sunshine. Oh, so
I only heard enough to figure out that Patrick staked out a very bold position for something that ultimately amounted to damning Mario with faint praise during that entire... Like, I'm a stan. Like, yeah, it's not very good. But people who hate it too much... Right. I'm gonna die on that hill.
That was it. That's basically the
argument. You know what? I'm gonna go. Yes, sure. That's close enough. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. That's what I heard. I'm curious to see how much of a remaster is a remaster in some of these instances. What all they could add that could be very fun. Or like how they change presentation, stuff like that. Also, real quick, Patrick, I need you to weigh in one more time on one thing that I watched you beat this weekend, Ori and the Will of the Wisps, because I watched you wrap that game up, and I'm curious.
I loved Ori and the Will of the Wisps. I think it's a great game that still has some technical issues that wait for the next. There's a big patch coming. It was supposed to come last week. I guess it didn't. So wait on that maybe. But I think it's a really, really, really good game that identifies a bunch of the flaws of the first game and builds upon them tremendously. My problem was, and I'll end up writing a blog about this week, is that the ending is confounding in like the moral lessons it tries to impart about, I don't know, victims and how they choose to work through their abuse calling those things evil and calling people who are abused fundamentally evil. Bro, people that choose to be evil.
There's a line that hits and towards the very, very, very end of that game. I won't spoil what the line is, but I was shook. I was like, whoa. Like, gif of that kid like whole body convulsing and going backwards. Like, that is 100%. Oh man. Really, truly.
Yeah, it's yeah, it's, I'll end up writing a spoiler bit about it. It was, yeah, it only underscores the story was pretty light, and it got away with having a light story in the first one because the world and the mechanics were really stellar. And in this one, they try to go a little story heavier, mm-hmm. and I think only exposes some of its issues even more. And yeah, that line in particular, which is an arc of the whole game,
right.
regarding yeah, yeah, like yeah. the main basically, like, without explicitly spoiling, like the arc of the main villain, when it is revealed more about their nature and what has happened to them, and then where the game lands with, like, where the narrator, like, how they choose to characterize this villain is truly breathtaking in how shitty it treats the villain is the hero. I'm on their side now, actually. Ori is just this dipshit going around just wrecking stuff, and maybe this villain needs to be reconsidered.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad that most of the game was still good. That last section I watched you play is what I wanted from earlier sections in terms of the ways in which you were, like, linking together so many platforming things together. And I know, again, I'm not the platforming person, but that stuff looked fantastic. That final area seemed really, really fun.
Yeah, you were just, like, you're using several moves to, like, keep yourself in the air in a way that I wish that game had more optional difficult areas where, like, if the main, just different ways for you to, like, look, you know, hey, you want to stretch your wings out here. Like, we've set up parts of the world that are going to, you know, let you do that. Yeah. And instead of it just being the last, like, fourth of the game, which makes sense for the arc of it. But it's just once you get into that, like, flow state and you're using everything in front of you, oh, it's like just, it's so good. And I just wish there was, more of it.
Yeah. I think that's it. I think I don't have anything else to shout out. I don't think I have anything else to. Still other news that I'm itching to talk about, I don't think. Unless anyone else has anything else, I think it is time to truly finally wrap up, go on with our Mondays. You know, the Able Sisters shop has opened up in my town. I need to go buy some glasses, some cool new shoes, you know. So I got work to do. I actually have to deal with taxes today. Today's my finally get my fucking taxes together day. Yeah. So
wasn't all that extended?
Yes, but I have weird friends at the table means I have like a whole other thing to deal with, and I'd rather just get it all done now. Also, I don't know that the state of the New York, I don't know what the state of my New York tax extension is. I think that might be still currently due on the 15th, so we'll see.
I don't know. That Cuomo guy seems like he's just incredible, and everyone loves him now, so I'm
you
sure
mean President
he will,
Cuomo?
He will sort you
I
right
can't
the fuck
do
out.
This. I fucking cannot do this motherfucker.
Weirdly don't bangable, yeah, too.
Don't buy the hype. If you're like, if you've been like, that motherfucker
Did
seems
you not
presidential.
See the Jezebel thing, Patrick?
No,
I don't want to.
Oh, it's
to
about
now.
Crushing on Andrew Cuomo. It's...
Listen, I'm not telling you you can't crush on whoever you want to crush on. Crushes are bad. Crushes are fleeting, and they are
and often irrational.
And often, almost, just deeply irrational. Get you into trouble if you follow him. I don't mind you being like, that man, I would fuck. What I care about is, would you vote for that man again? Because the answer should be no, because he has done everything he can to completely defund, or not to completely defund, but to further defund healthcare in this state, even in a time of crisis. He has, like, consistently been on the wrong side of things in many ways, like his father. Which I had not known until very recently, his father, who is also the governor of the great state of New York, ran on an explicitly homophobic campaign strategy when he won the governorship, which is wild, and people should look that up. The Cuomos, none of them. I don't want any of them in my life. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think it's just very frustrating that, like, I think the medium of getting news through television has this amazing power to erase context and the past.
Yeah.
And so what we have is a shared drama where characters appear. And because, like, there are there are at least two men who give press conferences all the goddamn time throughout the coronavirus. One of them is worryingly unfit for the job he's being asked to do. The other
one is
There's Donald Trump. No.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we can't make that joke here because Donald Trump can't. Also is
no, it's
terrible.
So good, but it's,
but
not,
it's a great,
there.
It's a great joke.
But, yeah, but Cuomo projects this like bare minimum level of competence and understanding of what is the current reality in his state, and we are so thirsty for someone who's like, holy shit, that guy, look at that guy, he's not in the Fuhrer bunker, he's out there in the world seeing what it's like. I love that man. I would die for him.
I would die
and
for him.
What he spent his life in public doing is completely absent from that, right? Yes. Like he shows up on like at the hour of crisis that he's spent years guaranteeing would go worse for the state of New York. His appearance on television forgives him all of that. It's yep. It's exasperating.
Well, I think it especially helps him because he's able to be the foil against two different
yes.
rivals, Donald Trump and Bill de Blasio, both of whom have been much worse and in different ways to the degree that Cuomo gets to like walk the line here. De Blasio, I think, is going to go down. I mean, people already didn't. No one really liked Bill de Blasio. He was always the lesser of a number of potential mayoral evils for us in the city. And the way that he was so flippant in February about the COVID-19, I think is going to bite him in the ass for the rest of his life. I think will really spoil his chances in popular politics and in big city and state and federal politics. Because he was one of the people who was the most like, hey, get out there. Listen, you don't have to change it. You just have to be more careful, social distance. Hey, here's a great movie to go see, which is not the right attitude to take because he seemed, I said this at the time, he wanted to come across like, you know, your older brother, your best friend, more than a parental figure, more than a figure of governance and a figure who is willing to make a hard call. Meanwhile, Trump has really moved between conspiracy theorist and authoritarian to the degree that now he is explicitly victimizing, but putting Cuomo in the position of victim, letting Cuomo play the victim, when in fact the real victims are the people of New York, in which Trump is now asymmetrically assigning aid to different states, which if you haven't read about this,
which is a pattern he'd already established.
Yeah, of course. Yes. So he'd already been playing favorites, but I think people expect that to be, I think so many people have a low key, have like a low key realist in them where they're like, well, everybody, there's like a little David Plotz on everyone's shoulder that says, listen, it's human nature to have favorites. And in any given administration, there's going to be, you know, fluctuations based on personal relationships. And that's just the way it is. And what you need to do is build those relationships. Part of a good governor is to have a good relationship with the federal branch and da 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 da. But I think a lot of people expect that to go out the window when a crisis happens and the president goes, all right, get it done, like help everybody. And in this case, what Trump has done is not done that at all in such a way that the discrepancy between what states like New York are getting and states like Florida are getting in terms of what the requested aid is remarkable, is like scary. It truly really is this sort of necropolitical stuff. Where the those in power are able to wield the kind of weapon, the control over death by determining who gets the bare necessities of life, right? Keep their hands clean while doing it.
And this is something governor can't really – like governor can right. go pick a fight on the airwaves and yes. see how that works out. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But this is really a fight that like – honestly, if anyone should have been lowering the boom on this shit, it probably would have been Nancy Pelosi the last couple of years, ever since she took control of the House, right? Like, no. If we earmarked funds for a thing, it's going – like, you are paying Puerto Rico or nothing else is happening, yes. right? Like, we said this money has to go here. That's not up for debate. We control the federal budget. That money is going out to the people it's meant for.
Yep.
And when that line wasn't defended – the door opened to this. And once again, we're seeing the money get fucked with. And instead of any sort of hardball negotiation, we saw the CARES Act, which was, my God, won't someone think of the banks?
Someone,
won't someone think of Boeing?
Will someone please? Listen, they're bad at making planes already. What if we could give them money now so that they could waste this also? Please. Fuck. We can't get into the CARES Act. We don't have the time.
We can shout out the Instacart strikers, though. Good for them.
Yeah, absolutely good for them. That started today, correct?
Yeah. So, which it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because as I understand it, Instacart was already at a huge backlog for orders. I'm not sure if that's national, but I do know that in this area, I was talking to, so I have a shopper who was ex Instacart. I use a service called Dumpling, which is pretty cool. You sort of have a direct relationship with a shopper. They get a higher cut and pretty much all the tips. There's no in-store markup. I like it. It seems like a pretty young service, but it seems worker oriented. It seems like a cool alternative. But I was talking to one of the shoppers and they were saying that Instacart around here is basically asking you to schedule your delivery orders like 2 weeks out. So I'm really curious to see how the strike plays out, because it has the potential to be especially disruptive. But the thing that does scare me is also, man, if you've been waiting 2 weeks for your order and the strike happens, that's going to, like, there are people depending on orders and they're going to be in an awkward position. I think the strike is absolutely right. And this is on Instacart, but it's one of those places where the effects of it do get sticky, right? Like there is no way to hold this line without inconveniencing some people in the short term to defend the safety and well-being of a larger group over time.
Oh, what a fucking time. To all of you listening out there, I hope you are all staying safe. For those many of you who I know are going to work still because you were in an essential job, or because you're in a place where there have not been safety regulations put into place that keep you at home, or where you literally are in a position where stopping work right now is impossible, or not going into the workplace would be impossible for you financially, and you know, you don't have any other way of making money right now. Hearts go out to you. Hearts go out to those of you who are working from home or staying home. Be safe. Take the precautionary measures that you've been informed are the right ones for your situation. You know that our hearts are with you. Unfortunately, that does not keep you safe. All it can do is hopefully boost your morale a little bit. We'll be back later this week with more. I'm going to play some Mountain Blade. I don't know what else. What else is shit out this week? Is RE3 the big thing? RE3 was the big thing this week, right?
Yeah, but it's not out till Friday, I think.
Okay, so I will not weigh in on that, but that's fine. I hope everyone out there who is settling into their Animal Crossing routines is having a good day and having a good time. I hope that your island is as peaceful and beautiful as those of ours are here. Let's get into April. Here's what I want to say. When we next record this podcast, it's going to be April. April's going to bring a new energy. We're going to turn this ship around.
I got to catch a string.
I feel like you're cursing us.
April is it.
I feel like in the movie version of this, you just said that and we hard cut to like mid-April, and yeah.
Rob is covered in bacteria. It's like, I tried to call, what is a culture? I'm the culture now. Culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't you want to see my starter?
Bread.
Yeah. Bread. Starter. Yeah, exactly. All right. That's going to do it for us. Thanks, everyone. As always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. How about you, Kato?
At @A_Kato_appears.
Rob.
They're baking me. Let me out of here.
And Patrick.
Patrick Loving.
God. As always, you can find everything we do, twitter.com/waypoint, waypoint.vice.com. As always, fuck capitalism. Go home if you're allowed to. Otherwise, good luck in your workplace. Peace.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
This fucking tasty video has to exist.
It does. I looked all over.
It has to be real. I remember it so vividly.
I looked all over.
It was a layer of bread and then pepperoni and then cheese and then like fucking shredded
chicken that you had.
Or something in here. Shredded and then bread chicken. And then fucking Oreos.
You keep looking. You keep us in the loop. Have a good one. Bye. Hi, take Mia. Care. Hi. Bye.
Oh. Bye.
Rob.
Hey.
You also sound a little peaky, Austin. Just a touch.
Okay.
That's Austin possible. Sounds fine to me.
I'm looking at my waveforms. They seem pretty okay. Let me bring it down a little bit, a touch. All right.
Thank you. Sounds better.
Yep. Yeah. The nice thing here, though, is you know that like terrible sound that I make sometimes by mistake because I hit a wire? That is fixed now. So that is the mic arm. So that is at least gone.
Yeah.
All right. Let me go to time.is. And also, let me get a backup going. Boom. All right. Backup recording.
Okay.
Y'all ready to clap?
No.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, now I'm ready.
All right. 15.
It froze.
Yeah. Oh. I thought you said good for us, and then I realized you said it froze.
Good for us.
I was like, damn.
What
yeah.
mean either?
Like, damn, that was a good clap. Good for us.
Well done.
So do we need another clap, Rob?
Rob's, like, quarantine isolation story is that he's fraying at all edges at this point.
Buddy. Rob,
another
second.
Time signature.
Need another, 45.
Yeah, let's do 45.
There we go.
That's a clap.
Did we, though? Rob?
Rob clapped.
Okay.
I'm going to roll right into it. We're going to power through. I like that my possible episode title list is still just that time Rob said, some asshole with hands, which I don't even know what the reference was, but was a great line.
Oh, that's my description of the tasty video's aesthetic.
Right. Yes, of course.
Which... actually is a fair description of tasty videos.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, look at those pieces of shit and tell me the predominant, like, who is the author? Who knows?
Who knows?
It's some asshole with hands making something that will not work that well.
Yeah, uh-huh, it's perfect.
Fuck.
All right.